In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Stephen's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
Mighty Manfred here with you in Little Stephen's Underground Garage, and it's time for your coolest conversations presented by Hard Rock. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow and subscribe, rate, and review. Got a special chat lined up for you today. My guest is famed pro wrestling manager and musician, Jimmy Mouth of the South Hart. He's managed the likes of Jerry Lawler, Hulk Hogan, and even Andy Kaufman. And his music career began with the Memphis, Tennessee band The Gentrys, from their big hit Keep on Dancing in 1965 through the late 60s and 70s, when he led the band and garnered more chart hits. We'll hear a bit of Keep on Dancing now, and then I'll be back with Jimmy for your coolest conversations presented by Hard Rock in Little Stephen's Underground Garage.
I keep on dancing, boy.
Mighty Manfred here with you in Little Stephen's Underground Garage, and I have got a very, very special Coolest Conversations lineup for you today, because I am joined by Jimmy Hart, the Mouth of the South, professional wrestling manager, executive, composer, and musician, best known to us here in Little Stephen's Underground Garage as a member of the Gentrys, had the big hit with Keep on Dancing in 1965, and among other hits, scored higher with their version of Neil Young's Cinnamon Girl than Neil did back in 1970. As a manager, he worked with the likes of Andy Kaufman, Jerry the King Lawler, Hulk Hogan, and many other wrestling greats. Jimmy, my man, how are you?
I'm doing great, man. For this is awesome, man. Thanks for having me on.
You are certainly welcome. I'm very excited and honored to be talking to you. Now, look, I know the Gentrys were from Memphis, but are you from there originally?
You know what? Originally, I was born in Jackson, Mississippi. And one day I woke up, my mother did, single parent, right? And when I was eight years old, we went to Memphis because we realized that every city's got a Wendy's and a McDonald's, so you might as well move where it's a little bit warmer year-round. And so we moved to Memphis, and that's where I was raised.
Well, I was reading a biography about Sam Phillips a couple of years back, and it made a point to talk about how important major wrestling or wrestling was to that area back then, and how one of Phillips's sons, I can't remember whether it was the older one or the younger one, but one of his boys was wrestling as a kid, but not just with other kids. He was like wrestling adults, like in the whatever the major venues were at the time, did a whole bunch of bouts. And then his mom was invited to one of them, and she said, cut that out. You know, get our kid out of there. You can't be doing this. So I know that area's got a rich history with wrestling. But for you, was it music or wrestling that first steered you to the future?
Well, it was a little bit of everything, but you know, Jerry Phillips, he was the youngest son of Sam Phillips. Knox Phillips was our producer on our Sun stuff over at Phillips Recording Studio after we came off the hits from MGM. And that was my kind of second group of Gentries there. The original group was on MGM. Our second group of Gentries, everybody left me alone. I was by myself. We went to Sun Records, and which was at Phillips Studio then. Sam Phillips signed us to a contract. Knox Phillips produces, but Jerry Phillips was the one that got in professional wrestling.
Okay. All right. So now with yourself, was there like a, what sort of music was there in your, when you were growing up at home? Like, did your mom play lots of records? Was it just the radio?
Well, my mother played piano, but she wrote a song back in the day for Eddie Arnold. And she had a top four hit with Eddie Arnold by called Enclosed One, Broken Heart. And she had met Colonel Parker in Jackson, Mississippi, played the song for him. He loved it. And of course, he had to give them all the publishing and half writers for it. But that's the way it worked back then. And so that's how my career really started. And then from there, I just kind of, I guess I got a little bit of her talents. And so that's how it all started back in the day for me before I had the record deals.
Okay. So when you were coming up then, I know that in the Gentries you sang, and you're one of a couple of backing singers before the Sun era group going forward. Do you play any instruments?
You know, I play an auto harp, like Cyndi Lauper. Everything I wrote in the wrestling world and also in the Gentries with our original stuff was on an auto harp. Then we'd go in the studio. Then we'd, you know, put the drums, the guitars, and whatever, bass or whatever. And that's how we really did everything.
Well, did you play any bands before the Gentries?
No. You know what? The closest I came to doing anything, I sang 16 tons when I was 8 years old for a guy named Red Foley. Red Foley had came to Memphis on the Ozark Jubilee tour, and my mother curled my hair and had me sing on stage going 16 tons and what do you get? But that's the first time I got to meet Elvis Presley back then, because Colonel Parker was there and he introduced Elvis to my mother. And I remember Elvis telling her going, "You know, I have a pair of earrings, cufflinks like your earrings, Miss Hart." And so that's the first time I met Elvis was back then.
Oh, wow. So, now, so you were 8 at the time, and you're getting on into school. I've read that the members of the Gentries all went to Treadwell High School in Memphis. Did the group form when you were in high school or out of high school?
Our original group started at Treadwell High School in Memphis, Tennessee.
So you guys, you're forming, you're in high school. Guitar player Larry Raspberry, he sang lead vocals, right?
Right, Larry. There was Bruce Rose, myself, and Larry. We all sing everything, but Larry was on "Keep on Dancing," and of course, when we got on the Sun label, is when we all shared vocals and a lot of stuff. When we got on the Sun label, that's when I wrote the song "Why Should I Cry?" That was a top 60 hit for us. Then we had then we found Cinnamon Girl. Now we had met Neil Young. Our original group met Neil Young at the original Whiskey a Go Go back in the 60s, and We and the Buffalo Springfield then were our warm-up group, believe it or not. They didn't even have a record album out then. And so I remembered that song back in the day, and I always loved that song when they did all the original stuff. And then I found an album with it on there, and that's how we kind of did our version of it. And the Gentries were back in the saddle again, baby.
That's right. Okay, so you and you mentioned Bruce Bowles. He's another the other backing singer. So did you guys ever, I was looking through the track listing of those early albums, that sort of first version of the band, but I hadn't realized until I was looking at these live clips that you and Bruce are kind of doing like a backing vocal thing. Did you guys ever work up any kind of Sam and Dave styled numbers?
No, you know, we did a little bit of everything back then, because back then it was all like, when we were in high school, the way we made our extra money in high school was going to doing the sock hops everywhere, like T. Walker Lewis YMCA and a lot of the places around town. And of course, back then they had the Battles of the Band. One of my favorite groups was Tommy Burke and the Counts and the Guillotines back then. The Guillotines had a little success too back in the day with a song called "I Don't Believe." But back then they'd put these little buckets in front of all the bandstands, and all the kids would buy their tickets, and whatever band they liked that night, they'd drop their tickets in the band. That's how you made your money. And so we all did Sam and Dave. We did all this stuff because Isaac Hayes played on our first album, and the Bar Kays, who had Soul Finger out back in the day, they were a big horn group back then. Yeah. They played a lot of horns on our albums too. So I'd always loved the black groups back then. I got to go see, of course, Little Richard when he was in town, and Sam and Dave, of course, and just so many of the groups back. Ike and Tina Turner. I got to see Ike and Tina Turner back when they were at some of the clubs there too. But I always loved their. I just loved the black music back then. It was just great.
Well, let me. You mentioned here about playing the sock hops and these battle of the bands. So how much were you guys actually playing locally or regionally before you released Keep On Dancing? Was it just like a weekend thing every now and again? Or were you, or
every week, every weekend. And how we got our record deal was George Klein, who was Elvis's big buddy back then. He had a show called Talent Party. And on Talent Party, it was kind of like a poor man's American Bandstand, but it was local. But so he's the one that kind of discovered us. And a guy named Chip Smolin had come to town. Chip Smolin was a record producer. And so George said, look, I want you to meet Chips. Chips, this is the Gentrys. They've got a big following here in town. And I'd like to film, like to, for you to cut something for them so I can put them on Talent Party. So we went in and I sang a song called Time Is On My Side by the Rolling Stones. And so we did that for George. And that led to the other songs that we cut. And finally, MGM came through town and we had the lucky enough to get on MGM label, and they put the song out in Nashville where people didn't know us because they thought we were just kind of a fad in Memphis at the time. And that's why people were buying the single, because we put it out locally and really following us on the radio and everything because we were local. So we put it out in Nashville. We put it out in, I think, Chattanooga, Tennessee, and it became a monster hit up there back in the day for that time. And so when that happened, MGM signed us, and buddy, we were on the road, buddy. Dick Clark, right, where the American Bandstand, where the action is, Hullabaloo, Shindig, the movie Bikini World. And we did all the tours with Dick Clark and everything. So it was like, wow, all of a sudden we were one hit wonder. We had a few more records that hit, and that's how we really got started.
And so so Moment comes in. I know you mentioned putting out on the local label. He had a label, Youngstown Records.
Right.
Right. And so, but the song itself, so the Avantes were a black vocal group. They had done Keep On Dancing in 1963. So MoMA must have been familiar with the song. Who had you heard that song before before you recorded it? Were you familiar with it, or was this something MoMA said, I want you guys to do this?
Well, first of all, it was a white group, really, but the guy had a soulful voice. He kind of did Keep On Dancing, like he did it slower, like kind of Keep On Dancing. He had that soulful feel to it. I loved it. But I think Larry was originally one who found it, and then he brought it in, and then Chip said, well, look, we need a B-side, because we really had a song called Sometimes on the other side that Bruce and I were doing. It was kind of like a ballad, you know, kind of like Brett or somebody like that would have out. And it was really so. It's like, sometimes I cry when I'm lonely. And it did real well in Memphis. But we had a fan club president at the time called Pat Rayner. And she was a big fan of ours. And so one day you could call in the radio stations in, and it was on channel FM 100. A guy named Roy Mack. So every day he'd have the local hits. They'd play all the local hits.
Yeah.
So she called in and said, would you play the B-side of Sometimes? They flipped it over, and all we did was speed the version up where it was like, Keep On Dancing. And we speeded it up, and it was the B-side of the song. So what happened? It was so short that what Chips did, he stopped it and replayed the tape again. But that turned out to be the greatest gimmick of all, because people
Absolutely.
Would be on the dance floor dancing, then walk off the dance floor and have to run back on the dance floor again. So it turned out to be really a good break for us.
You know what? I had no idea about that until I just read about it. And then I went back and listened to the song. I was like, oh my God, That's it. It's just, you know, the song played through twice, basically, on one side. That is a great, great gimmick. So the tune hits number four in Billboard, number five in Cashbox. I've seen live clips of you guys playing it or lip syncing it, maybe to all sorts of television shows. Do you recall anything from those TV shows?
The first time we did American Bandstand, now we're from Memphis, we're in high school, right? So now we're out doing all this stuff, and the record company's flying us out to do promotion. So now we're going to Hollywood, California, baby, American Bandstand. We go, Dick Clark, you know, we knew Dick Clark. We heard about him and everything. We go out there in America, and they filmed two shows every 2 weeks, right? So we walk in, and they go, now here's where you put your makeup on. We're going, makeup? What? Because we didn't wear makeup. Now we go in there, and sitting in one of the makeup chairs was Roy Orbison. We're like, oh my God, Roy Orbison. Oh my God. He was on the first show. We were on the second show. And then the second time, years later, when we did American Bandstand, we were on there with the Grassroots, which is one of my favorite groups. But it was just great. Hullabaloo Shindig, where the action is. We did Hullabaloo with the animals and that. We did the movie out there with the toys who had out, you know, fire, fire, nose on fire, one of those crazy songs.
Oh, that was the Castaways, Liar, Liar.
Yeah, Castaways, yeah. But it was just such a great time, such a great era.
Well, Jimmy, I mean, you've been flown all around the country. Did you think you were the Beatles? I mean, you know what I mean, you know?
Well, but how we really got started, I'm going to jump back a little bit and bring up the Beatles thing. There was a show called Ted Mack's Original Amateur Hour, and that was filmed out of Miami Beach, Florida. And that was a nationwide show sponsored by Geritol. I remember that, but it was filmed at the Jackie Gleason Theater. And we won, once George Klein saw us, we had a talent contest at the fair that came through town. And the winner of the fair got to be on this nationwide show. Well, how do you know? We won the fair, believe that or not. So they put us on a train in Jackson, Tennessee, and they sent us all the way down to Miami. We did the show in Miami. We did a song called Do You Love Me by the Contours. And 2 months later, they called us. Y'all had the most votes. We went, what do we do? Well, we're bringing you back again. We went back again. We did the same song. We won again. The third time, we'd already signed the deal with Chips Moman and MGM. So we got disqualified our third time, even though we had to go to New York and participate because the ratings were so good with us being on there. It's the first time they had a group out with a little long hair and everything. But they called us. He called us the answer to the Beatles. And so that's how we kind of got started. We were kind of like the Memphis Beatles. And so with the long hair and the jackets, look like, we went to Lansky Brothers. We bought all of our outfits at Lansky Brothers, where Elvis and Johnny Cash and Jerry Lee Lewis and all the groups went down to Lansky Brothers to buy all of their outfits back in the day. And so we went down there, too. And that's where we had our suit coats made and our pants done. And so they were really responsible for kicking us off back then, too.
So you were, they flew you out for these promotional events. Did you do any, on the strength of the single, did you actually go out on the road and do like do any of these package tours or play gigs farther afield than just the Memphis area?
Oh, no, we had to go everywhere. We were up in Nashville, a lot of things we were able to drive up to do it, but the record company, MGM, really put some money behind us. One quick story, and I'll make it simple. While we were up there after we had our hits and we played the Whiskey a Go-Go, and I wish I'd have brought the picture because I'll try to figure out a way to get it to you. But on the top of the sign, it says the Gentrys, and our warm-up group was the Buffalo Springfield. They didn't even have a record album out then. But one day, and we were doing, once we got out there, we did all the stuff like American Bandstand, and then we did Where the Action Is, which was another Dick Clark show. With the and on that show, they were out there with, what was that group that... not the Dave Clark Five, but it was another local group. Oh, Paul Revere and the Raiders.
Yeah, the Raiders. They were the one of the action.
Yeah, they were a local group on there. Well, we had to go to a record shop to get our instruments. And while we were in there, there were some guys walking around there go, hey, you guys in a group? And I said, yeah, y'all in a group? He goes, yeah. He said, we're learning how to play our instruments. He said, we got a TV show that we're fixing to start working on. I said, what's your name going to be? He goes, The Monkees. And I went, well, nice meeting you. We got outside the door and I told Larry, I said, Larry, oh my God, that group will never be a hit. That's the worst name I've heard for a band in my life. The Monkees. Boy, was I wrong.
Okay. So, so Keep On Dancing, title track to the debut album. You were showing me that a moment ago. Another great song on there. I just wanted to ask about it. If in case you have any recollection, Brown Paper Sack, which I think is just a kind of a, you know, like a brown paper sack girl. It just,
he goes, hey, you girl, you better get away, girl. You treated me so bad, you might as well have been a brown paper sack.
So, the guy that I see that wrote that, Larry Rogers,
he played keyboards for us after our original group broke up, and he finally went on to produce Kenny Rogers up in Nashville.
Oh, wow, cool. I love that track.
Yeah, it was good.
So, how did that work when you guys were in the studio? I mean, you know, I know you. You guys would try and work on your own songs, but they're also. But I mean, how much control did you have over what was getting recorded? Were they kind of handing you things and saying you guys need to do this, or how did that work?
We had no control back in the day. Chips Moman found all the songs and got his own writers. They did publish it. We didn't know anything about it. Hell, our first royalty check came in, and we went, "Is this it?" And he goes, well, we have to take the money out of it to cut the second album. I said, why don't we get the money for the first album before we cut the second album? Because if we're not going to make money off it, why cut the second album? That didn't go over too well with him. But we wind up cutting two big albums and having the best of by having one hit. And then, of course, but everything got a little bit better. Once our original group broke up, yeah. And I was kind of the last man standing, that's when I went over and saw Knox Phillips, Sam Phillips' son. And they were at Phillips Studio. The money that they had got for Elvis when Sam sold all the rights to him, he opened another studio behind the original Sun Records called Phillips Studio.
Right.
And that's and so that's when I went over there and I played on the auto harp. I sat there and played Why Should I Cry? And they loved it. And Shelby Singerman had just signed a deal with them out of Nashville about releasing some of the old Sun stuff, you know, with Carl Perkins and Jerry Lee Lewis. And so they were looking for something a little bit younger at the time. And that's when he heard the song and said, I want to sign the Gentrys. And so I had another group I'd put together, and we were on the road playing too. And then all of a sudden, we're back in the saddle again, man. I got Why Should I Cry on the charts. We're booked every weekend, every night. And then we followed up with Cinema Girl, another chart record for us. So it was like the original Gentrys, and we still kind of kept the name going through all the years.
Well, before we touch more on that, you had mentioned being in the movie It's a Bikini World, and that
right
shot like in 65, came out in 67. There's a great scene of you guys, and they're singing in the midst of a lot of go-go girls dancing around. I think the tune you're doing is Spread It On Thick.
Spread It On Thick, yeah.
Spread It On Thick. Do you recall anything about appearing in the movie, what that experience was like?
Well, we did a beach scene, and we had these velours on, but we had got it Lansky Brothers, and I thought, man, shouldn't we wear beach shirts or something back then? Because my favorite group of all time was the Beach Boys back in the day. And we did a lot of tours with them. And at the original Beach Boys, the only one that wasn't with us back then was Brian. He didn't go back then, but it was everybody else was just great. And we did a lot of tours with them. And so, but I thought we had these red velours on, and we were doing Spread It On Thick like peanut butter and jam. And so, It was just so much fun doing it. Like, everything was so quick and so fast. We were out of high school, and all of a sudden, we were just on TV. Every time you turn around, the Gentrys. But it was just a crazy time for us back then. But it was a great time.
Well, so what happened, Jimmy? Because you were talking about you were the last man standing. Well, what happened to the other guys around? I mean, it seems like about, I think 67, it kind of that version of the group ends. What brought it to an end, that version?
Well, really not a lot of hits, you know, and a lot of guys didn't want to play some of the places that we were playing at the time. And Jimmy Johnson went on to be one of a doctor, which was unbelievable. You know, we just got inducted into the Memphis Music Hall of Fame about three or four months ago. And all of us were there. Larry couldn't come. Larry had fell up in California and broke his hip, so he couldn't be there.
Oh.
But all the rest of us were there. And Jimmy Johnson turned out to be a great doctor. Our sax player, Bobby Fisher, has a great business down in Florida. Larry Wall did promotions for different record labels through the years. And the same thing with Bruce Bowles. And so we were all there, and we got to get on stage together and talk about the past, the present, and the future. So it was a great time. But just a lot of things happened to all the bands, you know. And that's what, and like I said, I was the last man standing. And I thought, well, I've got a high school education. I didn't go to college. But I always remember something. We were on a Beach Boy tour one time, bus tour for about 2 weeks. And yeah. I remember we were in Pensacola, Florida, and we stopped everybody went in to get sandwiches and stuff. And there was an old guy pumping the gas out there, the big old gas. And then he goes, y'all boys in a band? I said, yeah. And he goes, y'all go to college? And I said, no, sir, we didn't. He goes, well, it ain't going to do you no good anyhow. And I said, why? And he said, trust me on this. He said, I went to college, and look what happened to me. I'm out here pumping gas. He said, all college is going to do for you. He said, one day everybody's going to be looking for a job, and the guys that have a college education, they'll be before y'all in line. And he said, they still won't get the job. Y'all will with just common sense. And I remember that. I said, maybe he was right, you know.
Well, you've done pretty well so far. So
it's been great.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So you would mention about, you've last man standing, and you have the connections there with Knox and...
Knox Phillips had sent me over to Europe. I wanted to go to Europe.
Wait a minute. What time is this? When in this timeline? When were you sitting on it?
This is in the Gentrys, in the 70s. This was our album that had Why Should I Cry on it. Cinema Girl was on this. But another song was on here called Wild World. I heard a guy called Cat Stevens do a version of a song called Wild World. Sent the copy back to Knox Phillips. When I got back from Europe, buddy, he had the song already cut in the key I sang in, and we cut it. So we had like a 28. It was on Easy Listening, number 28 on Easy Listening called Wild World, our version of it with strings and everything. So that was on the Sun label, too. It's on this album.
Wow. Okay. So you get the stuff on the Sun. And then, like about I think it's like around, somehow you wound up doing it like a single on Capitol, like in 72.
Let me put this ring on your finger.
Yeah. So how did, were you still working with the Sun stuff or still had any ties to that? Or that was like just a one-off with Capitol?
Well, no, here's what happened. Knox Phillips was still producing us. So a guy named Marty Lacker, so if you look in all the Memphis Mafia books, Marty Lacker, along with George Klein, was Elvis Presley's best friend. At the wedding, they were there and everything. Well, Marty came to me and said, look, he said, I've got a deal with Capitol Records, Jimmy. He said, what about taking the Gentrys and let's go cut this song called Let Me Put This Ring on Your Finger. I'd written it on the Altar Heart, right?
Right, right.
And so he loved it. So we went over to a Stax studio. And we went over to Stax and cut that particular song over there. And on the way over there, though, he said, look, I got to go by and see Elvis. Go with me. And I went, okay. So went by to see where Elvis was. And we went to the house. And he said, come on in. So I went in. And that's the second time I got to meet Elvis when I was 8 years old. And then then finally, we're getting ready to go cut. We go to Elvis over there. And Elvis comes. He tells the maid that was there. He goes, tell him Marty's here. He goes, okay, Mr. Marty. He goes, hey, she goes halfway upstairs and go, Elvis, Marty's here. He goes, okay. Elvis comes down with a robe on. He looked great. The black hair, didn't have the shades on. He goes, where y'all boys going? He goes, here, I brought this paperwork over to you. So he gives it to Elvis. He goes, well, Marty, he goes, where y'all doing? He goes, I'm going to cut a record on Jimmy tonight. He goes, well, good luck. He goes, well, look, Marty, when you get back, give me a call. He goes, okay. So that's the second time I got to meet Elvis. And so through Marty, so we left, went to the studio and cut the song and everything else. And, you know, 2 months later, we had the record out on Capitol Records, you know, the same label the Beatles were on. So it's like you couldn't kill the Gentrys, no matter what. You know, we were on Stax Records.
Let me back up here. So you recorded on Stax, you said, that at the Stax studio. Did you do a single later on Stax?
Single on Stax, too. Yeah, another single on Stax, too, called Little Gold Band. And so we've been on Stax Records, Capitol Records. We're on Bell Records.
Right. And the Bell was before Sun or not?
Yeah, Bell was before Sun. Good. Remember, hey, man, you did your homework. You're awesome. And we did that before that.
Well, I just want to point out, Jimmy, because I've wondered before, the only other, there may be other, but the only other artist I've found that was on Sun and Stax was Rufus Thomas. So if you know anybody else, then let me know, because that's a pretty cool thing to be on both. Yeah, you know, both iconic, the most iconic labels from the town, to have records on both those labels is phenomenal.
Yeah, Rufus had out, remember, Walking the Dog, and we used to do that as a band too, you know, but it was just great, great history in Memphis, you know, with Rufus Thomas. I had to take Carla Thomas, Gee Whiz, her big hit she had, so it's just great being from Memphis and having all that nostalgia.
All right, so we got the Gentrys still going into, still doing stuff in up to the beginning of the 70s. Somewhere in here, you reconnect with Jerry Lawler, Jerry the King Lawler. So can you tell us exactly what your relationship with him was? When do you start doing stuff with him? And how does this kind of lead into the wrestling world?
Well, it was crazy. You know, Jerry and I went to school together, of course.
And this is Treadwell High School.
Redwell High School. And like any other group, you know, you play, as long as you've got big gigs, you play them, then we wind up playing the clubs, right? But we had a great sit-down gig at the Ramada Inn in Memphis, Tennessee. And Jerry Lawler called me one day, and he goes, Jimmy, he goes, look, he goes, will you help me with a wrestling album? And I said, I'd love to. Jerry and I went to school together. Like I said before, I went to music when we graduated. He went into wrestling. And so it was local wrestling back then, but it was doing really good. And so I helped him with the wrestling album, and that's when he said, we became good friends, because he goes, well, while the band was playing, they passed around a wine bottle and goes, hey, here's some wine. I said, no, don't think I don't drink. I gave it to Jerry. He goes, I don't drink either. They passed around a joint. They said, you smoke? I said, no, I don't smoke. And Jerry goes, I don't either. He goes, Jimmy, you played ball in high school. He goes, well, on the weekends, if you're not working, why don't you play softball with me, or during the season, we'll play football or whatever. And I started doing that with him. Well, I kind of worked my way in, but we became really good friends. And so all of a sudden, one day, he goes, look, I've got an angle. How would you like to help me do this angle on TV with Jimmy Valiant? He goes, he's coming in. And he said, I'd like to have the Gentrys on TV with me. And we'll be doing Keep On Dancing. We'll play like I'm going on tour with y'all. And he said, when we do it, then Jimmy Valiant's going to come out, bust me in the head with a guitar. And I said, sounds good to me. And so that's how I kind of got my feet wet in professional wrestling. And then later on, I helped him with a wrestling album. And later on, he just said, look, I want you to be my manager. He said, you can still do your music if you want to and help us do promotion. So I started doing the promotion and the album with Jerry Lawler. And the next thing you know, I'm on TV with him.
Well, all right. So you start working with him and you go on to be regarded. You are regarded as one of the greatest wrestling managers of all time. How did you get this nickname of Mouth of the South?
Well, here's what happened. I was doing a thing with Andy Kaufman, and I was managing him in Memphis because Lawler had brought him in from Taxi. And
oh, wait. So you mentioned Andy Kaufman. So how do we even get to Andy Kaufman?
Okay, here's how. I was managing different people in Memphis, Tennessee before I went to New York, right? Well, Andy Kaufman had called Jerry Lawler and said, look, he goes, I do this thing where I do intergender wrestling, where I wrestle these women. And Lawler said, well, if you want to be on TV, come on down here. So we brought him down. And so and I was just managing then. So I started managing Andy Kaufman along with some of the other wrestlers, of course. And that's how Andy and I met back in the day, and which turned out great. But going back, how I got the name Mouth of the South,
okay.
What happened after the TV show one day, there was a radio station there, a guy named Ron Jordan, who's still on radio in Memphis, believe that or not. And it was on a radio show called FM 100. So we went up there and we shot an angle with Andy Kaufman, and I'm going, every time Andy tried to talk, I'd interrupt him with something. And so the DJ goes, Andy, you're going to realize that's why they call Jimmy the Mouth of the South. And I went, oh, I like that. I was thinking to myself. And so after that, I started calling myself the Mouth of the South. So when I went to New York with Vince McMahon up there, I just kept that that nickname, Jimmy Hart, Mouth of the South.
So this the Kaufman thing, how did your relationship play into the Lawler-Kaufman feud then? Because when you were managing both guys, but that wasn't known at the time, right?
Right. But I turned on Lawler. What happened? Lawler broke his leg playing football. And so that's when Jerry Jarrett, who had the company at the time, called me and said, Jimmy, we're fixing to build this whole territory around you. And because Lawler was the hottest thing going, Lawler was the hottest babyface, which was a good guy, and the hottest heel, which was a bad guy. But he couldn't fight. He couldn't fight himself. So we had to use him sparingly on what we used for him. But all of a sudden, they turned me into managing. I had the Iron Sheik before he went to New York. I had King Kong Bundy before New York, Rick Rude before New York. So many of the guys down there I had before I managed them up in New York. And so they built everything around me till Lawler came back. And Lawler and I had the big feud down there, you know, because what I went on TV and said, Lance Russell goes, Jimmy, the confident to Jerry the King Lawler, everybody wants to know what's his update, because he was in the hospital at the time. This was the second weekend, and Lawler wasn't on TV. And I said, Lance, what do you do when a horse breaks his leg? You shoot him. Lawler's no use to Jimmy Hart anymore. Well, all of a sudden, the people go, woo, woo. Well, maybe we knew we had a home run then, so we were off and running. So I just managed all the bad guys against all the good guys in the territory until Lawler came back. And that's when I met Hulk Hogan. I'd seen Hulk down there years before that when I was doing the music thing. And
down where?
Down in Memphis.
Memphis, because, okay.
Yeah, Hulk was wrestling down there as a guy called Terry Boulder down there. He had the blonde hair, bigger than life, but he was called Terry Boulder. And he wasn't Hulk Hogan then. And so later on, when we had the big feud going, that's when we brought Hulk back in as Hulk Hogan. He was up in Minnesota doing it. So I'd bring different people in to go against Lawler, because if Lawler won, he got 5 minutes with Jimmy Hart, right? So
yeah.
This went on for month after month after month until we wanted to kill the program, you know?
Wow. So what at some point, wasn't there something about Lawler would play some song that was the music, the backing was like kind of like the thing from Ghostbusters? And
oh, yeah.
He was calling you a wimp or something.
Yeah, Wimp Busters. What they did back then, you could take the tracks and overdo them. You know how it was. You could get by with a lot of stuff way back then. So they added, they made T-shirts called Jimmy Hart Wimp Busters and had me with like the Ghostbusters. And so he did a song called Wimp Busters, but it was about Jimmy Hart, you know. And I was able to do a lot of my music down there. You know, we did the songs like Lance Russell's Nose, who was our DJ. I mean, our commentator, our MC. And
right.
Then we did We Hate School. And I kind of had a wrestling album down there, too, before I went to New York. And so it was so great being down there. You could do everything you really wanted to do. We could do TV and radio. And it was just no strings attached on everything. So, and we had so many great stars down there. Randy Savage started down. Heck, The Rock started down there. Stone Cold came through down there. The Ultimate Warrior came through. Him and Sting. Some of the major stars in the business started right there in Memphis, Tennessee.
So what was it? What is it about Memphis that, I mean, to me, I mentioned reading back about stuff in the 50s. There's this great kind of wrestling culture there, but it seems like it never sort of petered out. It just kept going, and it became this, you know, fertile ground for all these future wrestlers. What's in the water in Memphis, Tennessee?
Well, we had a great territory back then, and we had major places we could run, and the fans were so loyal back then. On Monday night, think about it, Monday night, one of our biggest places was the Mid-South Coliseum, 11,000 people on Monday night. Tuesday night, we'd go all the way to Louisville, Kentucky, another 8,000 people. Evansville, Indiana on Wednesday night. Then spot shows, which are smaller buildings, on Thursday and Friday night. Jackson, Tennessee, you hold about 8,000 people. That was down there on like Thursday nights. Tupelo, Mississippi on Friday nights. Saturday morning, live TV, and the Saturday night driving all the way back to Nashville for wrestling up there. And all that was driving back then. But the fans were just so loyal.
Wow, man, that's great. I mean, that many people like on a Mondays and Tuesday nights.
It was great.
So you mentioned, going up to New York. Well, why leave Memphis and go to New York? And how long were you up there in the New York area?
10 years in New York before I went to WCW and back to New York. And I still do stuff in New York now. We do radio and TV for them and everything. And they still put action figures out on us and everything. But what a great company to work for all these years. They're so, Triple H runs it now. But Vince McMahon had it back then. But Vince was great to me. Vince is the one that brought me the megaphone to use, you know.
All right. Yeah. Well, that helps being mouth of the South with a megaphone. And you can whoop people with it.
Oh, yeah. It was a great gimmick. And in Memphis, I had a cane. But when I got to New York, Mr. Fuji had the cane up there. So I didn't want the cane shoved where the sun don't shine on me. So I didn't have a gimmick up there. But Vince brought the gimmick to me. And, of course, Triple H, now he's in charge of everything. And so it just it's stronger. Wrestling's stronger than ever now. But going back to the story about that, when I went up to New York, they called me. A guy named Howard Finkel, who was our commentator back then, saw me on Memphis TV through the videos. And so they called me one day and said, look, we're starting a show called WrestleMania in 3 months. And we saw you. Would you like to be part of the company? Buddy, I said, feet don't fail me now, baby. And so, buddy, they sent me a plane ticket. I went up there and I was there for 10 years on 10 WrestleManias. I was on the very first WrestleMania, which means so much to me. You know, so many things means great to me, like being on the first WrestleMania, getting a Hall of Fame ring, being inducted into the Hall of Fame with Hulk and Piper and myself and Orndorff and Horton and of course, the Iron Sheik and Nikolai Volkov. Having that meant so much. Being inducted to the Memphis Music Hall of Fame 3 months ago with our original gentries, you know. There's just certain things in your life that always stand out. But when I went to New York up there, once again, now remember, I got out of music to get in wrestling. When I get up there, what do we do? One of the first things we do, we cut a wrestling album that went gold. And so we had the wrestling, which I had a couple of songs on the wrestling album. And then that led to me being able to go out on Epic Records and have an album that was released in Canada only. And this went 50,000 copies over there. It was gold over there. So I got a gold album for that too, but selling over 50,000 copies. Yeah, so my whole album's been based around music and wrestling, you know?
Well, here, I'm going to ask you about a song that one of my fellow DJs, the lovely Palmyra Del Ran, played a tune of yours on her program just a couple of months back, a tune called I'm Coming Home. Now, do you recall what that was? She was thinking that it went unreleased back in the day.
Well, you know what? The record company, Sun Records, had just called me about maybe reissuing another Gentry album because they found a lot of songs on it. And I thought, man, I'd love to. And they're the ones that kind of hooked me up to doing this radio thing for, the serious thing for you guys, which I was thrilled to do. And so they were going to send me a copy of it. So I've been waiting for 2 days. So I'm glad y'all got a copy. So they never sent it to me. But I do remember that back in the day. But there's so many songs that we never released back then that we could probably get another album out of it with a couple of new songs I'd like to put on it. So I'm hoping they reach out to me and go, Jimmy, you did so great on this radio show that we are going to release this Gentry album. That'd be great.
Well, I hope so. So I was going to ask you if you were involved in any other music projects right now. But so the answer, one answer to that is that, yeah, there's this possible release of Gentry's tunes that have never come out. Is there anything else music wise that you've got on the horizon?
Well, you know, when I was up in New York, of course, you know, Vince called me one day and goes, Jimmy, Vince McMahon. I said, yes, sir, Vince. He goes, I want you to cut a song on Shawn Michaels. Okay, Vince. Well, you know that song. If you look on Spotify, a lot of people say if Jimmy Hart's lips are moving, he's lying. But if you look on Spotify, that song to date has 18,200,000 hits on Spotify. And then, of course, after that, Vince called me and goes, Jimmy, Vince McMahon. Yeah. He said, I want you to cut a song on the American Dream, Dusty Rhodes, you know. And I cut the song for Dusty, which did real well. And then that led to the, of course, Nash and Hall, you know, the NWO. I cut the Wolfpack song, you know. We did that. We did so many of the songs over there for WCW. And then for WWE, the song, like I said, for Sean, and, of course, the song for Million Dollar Man, Money, Money, Money. Just so many of the songs, all the Honky Tonk Man songs, the big one, A Hunk, A Hunk, A Honky Love, and You Ain't Nothing But A Honky Dog Baby. So we did all those songs up there, so I've been blessed.
Right, but do you outside of the Gentry's thing, is there any other music projects that are like going to come out soon or that you're working on right now?
Well, we Huck and I had an album out a few years back called the Wrestling Boot Band song album, and one of those songs, a movie company had just called the record company that had it on, who just called us. I got to get with Hulk to see if he wants to do it or not, because Hulk has publishing on everything. But it's a movie coming out that I forget the name of it. But they want to use the Wrestling Boot Band song on that. And it's kind of a beach type song. And they want to do that. But I'm getting ready to crank up a little bit. I've got the urge to start singing again. I do still a lot of Comic Cons and stuff, especially when I do autograph things for WWE and promote WrestleMania is coming up again in April. So if you get a chance, get your tickets for it. Now it's going to be in Las Vegas. But a lot of people have called me to maybe do some music on some of the shows out there, like the Comic Cons and stuff. But I get permission to film before I do anything. So, but like I said before, I might be doing something coming up soon. But I'm fixing to dust off the old auto harp and bring it back out and maybe start back writing a few things again.
I think this is the time. This is the time, Jim. That sounds good. So let me double check there. Thinking about any upcoming events that you have, it's going to be something to tell you. You said it's in April. What was that event?
I got to do a good little plug here. This is Real American Beer. I'm on the Real American Beer Tour with Hulk Hogan. But if you get a chance, it's called Real American Beer. And you'll see Hulk Hogan, Jimmy Hart, and a cast of some good people on tour promoting this Real American Beer. And it's doing great, man. It's really doing very, very good.
So you guys are going to be out on the road and doing events to promote the beer?
We do the big signings. You know, Hulk comes in and we do the grocery stores and a lot of the bars and everything. But the crowds have been phenomenal. And everything's been great. But we were just on Pat McAfee's show a couple of weeks ago promoting the beer and everything else. And so it's been doing great. So we're really excited about that. And there's a couple of other projects that Hulk's got going on. And thank gosh, we've been friends for 43 years. So he always takes me along with him when we do them. And of course, this is Hulk's Beach Shop right here. If you're ever in Clearwater Beach, Florida, please come by the beach shop. You know, Tani, she runs it down here for Ron Howard, not the Ron Howard on TV, but the Ron Howard name, Ron Howard. And so, but Tani runs this for him. And then if you get thirsty or want some food, three doors down, we've got Hulk Hogan's restaurant right down the street down here for us.
So you're down in Florida right now. Where is home for you, Jimmy? Is it still in Memphis or not?
No, I live in Clearwater. I've been going from Memphis about, I guess, maybe 15, 16 years and everything. I still love it down there. I still go down to see Jerry the King Lawler, my friends at Lansky Brothers, and just all the people down there. I go by the old studio, the old Sun studio, and see it. And you know, go down memory lane, you know.
Well, that's a long street for you. That's great.
Well, it has been. But that's what made me so excited about the people up in Brentwood, Tennessee, up there that kind of refurbished the Shelby Singleton label. And when they talked about maybe doing releasing another Gentry album, and I said, well, let me put a couple of new songs on it, too. So hopefully they'll reach out to me. And after we're doing this interview, so we can really get it going, because I think we could really push some albums now since I do the Comic Cons and all the stuff. And since I've had got a little bit more famous besides music, being with the WWE and doing stuff with them through the years, you know, so more people know who Jimmy Hart was and about the music.
Well, all this sounds like a great plan. And if Jimmy, I want to thank you so much for talking with me today and making our coolest conversation so special, man.
Well, we love you, baby. Remember, keep on dancing.
All right. You know what we're going to do? We'll give a listen now to the Gentry's hit version of A Cinnamon Girl. We were talking about that, the Neil Young tune. You guys actually had a bigger hit with Cinnamon Girl than Neil did back in the day. It's the Gentry's Cinnamon Girl and Little Stevens Underground Garage. A portion of their cover of Neil Young's Cinnamon Girl. That was the Gentry's here in Little Stevens Underground Garage. I'm the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to band member Jimmy Mouth of the South Heart for joining me today to talk about his music and wrestling careers. Thanks also to Sammy Semenza and Kurt Baker for producing and editing our podcast. Jossie is a contemporary David Bowie-influenced glam rocker based in Nashville, Tennessee, and he's just released his fourth album titled Here Comes the Good Part. And we'll find out all about it next time around when Jossie joins me for our Coolest Conversations presented by Hard Rock here in Little Stevens Underground Garage.
Buddy, you're a boy. Make a big noise playing in the street. I'm gonna be a big man someday. You got mud on your face, you big disgrace. Kicking your can all over the place.
Some things are better when they rock. The Seminole Hard Rock Hotels and Casinos rock around the clock with nonstop casino action, rooms fit for the king, pools, spas, restaurants, and clubs for every taste and temptation. Seminole Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Tampa or Hollywood, Florida. We will rock you.